From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for March 11th, 2022. While your Milwaukee Bucks are racking up a lot of frequent flyer miles, they're on the road this entire week. And today is National Wash Your Nose Day. You need a whole day for this? In a show of solidarity with Ukraine, Canadian restaurants are rebranding their famous potato dish, poutine. They're doing this so there's no confusion with Putin, the power-hungry autocrat who invades peaceful neighboring countries, while poutine is fries and cheese gravy. So you can see the confusion. In response to the invasion of Ukraine, the International Cat Federation is banning all Russian cats from entering competitions. I'm betting those cats are pounding vodka and celebrating the time off. A Florida man blamed Vladimir Putin for his speeding ticket. His excuse for going 50 to 30 was, "I just found out that Putin is going to launch a nuclear war and I was just trying to get home." So it's good news, bad news. The good news is no nuclear war. But the bad news is our speeder still got a ticket, which he wouldn't have to pay if there was a nuclear war. Man, he can't catch a break. In a tit-for-tat move to counter the sanctions from the USA, Russia said they might not bring back an American astronaut from the space station in their Russian-made capsule. The Russians also made the Lada, universally known as the worst-built car on the planet. I think our astronaut would be safer if he waited for an Uber. And finally, our tax tip of the week is from the NAPC. That's Ukraine's IRS. They stated there's no need to declare captured Russian tanks and equipment as income. So if you have a tank, it's finders, keepers, losers, weepers. On the podcast today, we have Steve Giles, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesang, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. This is probably the time of year when many of our listeners are appreciating some good news on the tax front, even if it is coming from Ukraine. Not a great week overall for the markets. The NASDAQ down 3.5% this week, down 470 points. The S&P 500 down 125 points, down 2.9% this week. And the Dow shed 671 points, down 2% to close today at 32,943 for the year. The tech heavy NASDAQ down 17.8%. The S&P down 11.6%. And the Dow down 9, all those numbers including dividends. I think worth pointing out, the yield on the 10-year Treasury bounced significantly higher this week, closing the week at 2%. And as importantly, though down about 5.5% this week, crude oil continues to trade well above $100 a barrel. I think a thing that many of us have been keeping a close eye on over the last couple of weeks, certainly, I think speaks to some of the broader conversations that are out there right now. You know, Joel, I think the economic stuff's a good place to jump off this week in particular, as we talk about a lot of the issues that are going on in the market right now, we're starting to see them reflected in the consumer. And as we all know, consumers are kind of the critical driver of U.S. economic growth. And so when the consumers start to feel a little bit less happy about what's going on out there, I think investors should take notice. What did we learn this week?
Well, Kyle, we had a report today from the University of Michigan, which has been surveying consumers for something like 70 years, and they do a twice a month index. And today their index showed a big drop from where it ended up in February. It's a big drop from where it was a year ago, and it's kind of concerning some of the things that consumers were saying. It was the as far as the outlook for personal finances, it was the worst it's been in the years of the survey, is in terms of forecasting for year ahead inflation. It was the highest it's been since 1981. So, those are some concerns, because we know that consumer sentiment a lot of times leads into consumer decision making. And when we know that 70% of our economic drive is from consumer spending, you know, that can be alarming.
And I think, you know, one of the major issues that so many consumers are concerned about is this inflation measure. We saw data from the Consumer Price Index this week pointing out that while we had seen a little bit of a slowdown in the rate of inflation, even if we were still inflating, it appears now that we're back on the train of, you know, higher and higher inflation, not just higher prices.
That's right, Kyle. So the year-to-year increase in the consumer price index was 7.9%. That's the biggest it's been since it was 8.4% back in January of 1982. One of my questions is, though, how much do people read beyond the headline? Because that headline is you know, is big. That 7.9%, you know, biggest in four decades. But if you look beyond that, you start seeing things like, you know, the monthly increase in the CPI. More than a third of it was from gasoline prices going up 6.6%, and we know that that's going to keep going up because that survey was taken before February 24th when Russia attacked Ukraine, and we know that gas prices have gone up in the 2 weeks after that. When you strip out things, the most volatile things like fuel costs and food, then we see that core CPI actually did what you were saying before, that it's gone up on a monthly basis, but it was actually lower. The increase was lower this last month than it was in the 2 months before that. So there's a sign that maybe, you know, things aren't quite as alarming as the headline would say. And getting back to the consumers, I mean, consumers are pretty capricious. You know, I mean, those consumer sentiment numbers can be pretty fickle. So we don't know how much of their fear of inflation and their outlook on incomes is based on how they're really feeling about their own situation, or whether it's sort of conglomerating all these things of the headline numbers on inflation and the Ukraine, the concerns about Omicron, you know, all those sort of feed into how people might be feeling. And that might be, it's a show and tell sort of a thing, you know, they can tell the pollsters that they're really concerned, but are they showing it when they get to the cash register?
And I think that's such a critical consideration, is that the headline number, especially given the volatility we're seeing in oil prices right now, is probably going to continue to look vastly different than what that core number looks like, stripping out in particular energy. And so I think, you know, even if we continue to see that headline print higher and higher, at least as long as oil prices are the major driver of that conversation, now there's some signs that, you know, we may be seeing a little bit of easing pressure, at least in the rest of that basket of goods. And of course, you know, while energy prices are an incredibly important piece of spending for the average consumer, it isn't the only thing you're going to be spending money on. So I think, you know, important to point that out. You know, beyond the inflation numbers, the consumer numbers, data on unemployment claims, job openings this week.
I'm sorry, I'm muted. So those are still looking pretty good. The all the labor market numbers are you know, encouraging. And even in the consumer sentiment survey, consumers are saying, yeah, we're feeling pretty good about the labor market. You know, jobless claims are back to about where they were before the pandemic started. They're 38% below the 55-year average. So that's pretty impressive. The job openings are near record highs, and you know the employees are still facing the problem of, you know, having more openings than they can find workers to fill them. So those are all good news things that actually encourage consumers to spend money.
Yeah, I've had some interesting client conversations this week with two different couples where they're set to retire here, you know, in the next couple of months. And both of them, you know, as I'm talking to them about kind of what their retirement plans are, got to the point where they said, you know, we're not sure what we want to do right away, but longer term, I think we're going to do some kind of part-time job. And I think for a lot of people, it wasn't that they necessarily needed to. And in particular, for these two particular couples, it wasn't that they needed to take part-time work. It's that, you know, they thought that there was stuff they might want to do that they just didn't get to do it before, whether it was just working a job that they think is fun and getting paid a little bit, you know, ushering at a basketball game or a baseball game, which so many folks maybe can't make that a full-time gig, but who would have loved to, you know, have that be part of their income stream, who, when they retire, that's certainly something they're looking at. And then this afternoon, Chris, you introduced me to the word that I think pretty accurately describes some of that trend, the unretiree, right? So this, the individuals who have kind of re-entered the workforce. And I think, you know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes in the labor market with folks that are maybe looking to come back in.
Yeah, Kyle, if we think about what happened over the last 2 years during the height of the pandemic, we talked multiple times about the prevalence of retirement, as a lot of people that were close to the age of retirement retired what we thought maybe was earlier than they intended to because of concerns over health and safety and the pandemic, or because their net worth grew so quickly due to a rising value for homes, as well as their investment assets. And so you had a lot of people that retired early. And indeed, the job posting company actually keeps stats on the percentage of people that have retired that then return to the workforce. And they call that unretirement rate. And historically, that number, according to Indeed, has tended to be around 3 to 3.5% of retirees would return to the workforce. During the pandemic, or the height of the pandemic, that number dropped down to closer to 1.5 to 2%. So there's a lot of people that were retired that were not returning to the workforce, which to me indicated that people just weren't comfortable doing that at that time or didn't feel the need to do so. But over the last few months and the start of this year, we have seen that unretirement rate number go back up to be closer to that 3% range. That's a good news for the labor market, that people are choosing to come back to work if they feel the need to do so, that they feel comfortable doing that, and that you're getting back to a more normal labor market dynamic. So again, Kyle, to your point, many people that we talk to with retirement, you know, it's not about retiring because you never want to work anymore. It's retiring because your finances have given you the flexibility to do with what your time, what you want to do. And if that means working some part-time gig or doing some sort of side work that is meaningful to you, you know, that's what the purpose of retirement is in our minds.
So I have a question. Does that alter the planning for retirement or how you're investing for retirement if you end up unretiring?
I think that's always part of the plan. You know, I think it's an open conversation with your advisor, whoever's helping you with your retirement, to say, well, if I'm planning for retirement, well, am I looking to have some level of part-time income? Does that change maybe the retirement date when I can end my current job because I know I'll have some level of cash flow of working part-time in a job I enjoy? Or am I looking to lead a different style of lifestyle that doesn't include some level of part-time work? And what does that mean in terms of how much money I need to have set aside to achieve those needs? So there's all types of variables that go into it, but that's certainly a discussion that you should be having.
Well, I think part of the conversation as well is this need to continue to work versus the desire to continue to work. And I think the reality is that for a large portion of the population that maybe isn't as fortunate, you know, they have some income gaps that they need to fill, whether it's, you know, long term by finding a job that maybe they can carry, that can carry them through their mid 60s into their 70s, or whether it's, you know, just something short term to bridge insurance or to bridge till Social Security. Now, those are all conversations, I think, that, you know, that factor into kind of the planning piece. But I think it's also important to point out that if you're concerned about inflation, if you're concerned about some of the sell-off we've seen in the markets, you know, some of that is an erosion of this wealth effect that we've felt for the last couple of years. And I think in many ways that may be gearing more retirees up to push back into the workforce for another year or two, just because they want a little more security after some of the inflationary pressure we've seen and after some of the market sell-off we've seen in the last couple of months. And so if anything, Chris, I think that could help to drive that conversation a little more as we transition into spring and summer here.
I think it's worth pointing out, gentlemen, that there's the consideration also after being locked at home for 2 years that people are looking for some social aspects that come with being in the workplace. And whether they are financially independent or not, going back to work and being with people that they can relate to is a huge driver for some people deciding to unretire.
Steve, that's a great point. I actually coincidentally was reading some research about unretirement or reentry of retirees into the workplace. And a study that was done during the Great Recession found that most unretirees, if we call them that, that they were going back to work not because they needed the money or because it was a financial decision. It was more sort of the things that you said, the social engagement, the feeling of purpose. They basically found retirement wasn't as satisfactory as they thought it was going to be. So
yeah, maybe their spouse didn't want them at home as much anymore.
There are all sorts of factors, I'm sure.
I think worth pointing out, there's a significant economic benefit here. We have a lot of job openings in this country right now. We have a lot of potential for some additional discretionary spending. And for a lot of the retirees that are thinking about going back into the workforce, even if it's not necessary, that's an extra dollar in their pocket that could go towards boosting our own economy. And so you think about what the real long-term implications are, somebody getting back into the workforce is just a little more money that's being generated, a little more gross domestic product that can ultimately turn around and accelerate its way through the system. And so I think there are some meaningful economic benefits that are to be had here as we look at kind of the implications of the unretiree movement and see how long that sticks around. You know, Steve, we're in the middle of what I think is a pretty typical, albeit painful at the moment, market correction. And when I say pretty typical, I mean that these are the kinds of things we actually do see on a pretty regular basis. Nevertheless, I think this one's a little more obvious because the motivating factors are clearer than they are in a lot of other cases. But at the same time, I'm not sure, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, but I'm not sure that our response to it needs to be all that much different than what our response is to, your garden variety correction that we see every year or 18 months.
No, our response doesn't have to be different because it isn't any different than getting in your car and driving on the freeway. You aren't going to be in that car unless you know the brakes work. And just like your retirement portfolio, you got to make sure that you have a balance that is set up such that no matter what happens in the economy, no matter what happens with the markets, you still look smart and you've got an exit strategy that's going to either one, provide you plenty of downside protection so your portfolio holds up when we see market sell-offs, or you've got enough money set aside in fixed income to provide you with the kind of cash flow that you were hoping for without having to touch the stocks or sell the stocks while they're trading during a period of market weakness.
And I think you're spot on there. It's critical that when you get in the car, when you build that portfolio, that you make sure that the brakes are working. I think that's an apt analogy. I think the temptation right now, given how much volatility is out there, the temptation may be to chase returns in some places, right? The temptation may be to look at an oil stock and go, look at how great that's doing. Why don't I have more of that? And I think, maybe some reasons why, Chris and Steve, feel free to chime in here, but maybe some reasons why you don't want to use this current period to make some decisions about kind of the long-term strategy.
Yeah, I would just continue by saying that a well-built portfolio is going to get through any kind of market environment, Kyle. And as we help our clients and as we counsel them on distribution strategies and withdrawal strategies, it really is all about making sure that we are academic in that process, and we help clients check their emotions at the door. When you have a balanced allocation, you're not asking yourself how you feel about making a certain trade. Instead, you're saying we're going to make this particular trade because our asset allocation warrants a specific change. Where at the end of 2021, if your asset allocation model suggested you should only have 60% in stocks, and because the market did so well in 2021, you now had 65% of your portfolio in stocks, it's not an emotional decision to trim that 5% to get you back down to 60. And actually, by doing that, you're doing what Warren Buffett does, sell high, but you also have to have the courage of your convictions to buy low. We're at a time now when the market is down. And if your 60-40 portfolio ideally is now at maybe 50% in stocks, to have the courage of your convictions to perhaps tiptoe back into some more equities at a time when, hey, longer term, they're trading at a discount. We always tell clients, get a good deal for what you buy longer term, even if in the short term it becomes a little bit better deal. You're going to look smart. And it adheres to removing emotion from those decisions and making sure that you focus on those asset allocation strategies when you set up the plan.
I think a lot of people that buy stocks fall into two camps. There's the camp of the people that are thinking more short-term in nature. And I would call these traders, for you know, a lack of a better word. And they're looking for a purchase and then an exit, right? So they're looking to get in and get out within a certain time period. And a lot of times those individuals are looking for momentum, right? Something that's going up and they're going to buy it and then sell it before it turns. That's not really the way that we like to invest. We consider ourselves investors. That's the other category that I'd put people in. And if you're an investor, the mental model I always like to use is, think about buying a stock or buying a mutual fund is buying a business. You know, think of it through the model of, if I could never sell this, would I still want to purchase it, right? Is this have value on its own? Will the cash flows from what I'm purchasing be able to justify the price that I'm paying today? So I think people get in trouble when they start buying things because of the assumption that somebody else will buy it from them at a higher price. You're then becoming an individual trying to play the trader game. And if you're not skilled in that, that's a whole different world that you're talking about. So I just like to remind people to consider that you're a long-term investor and try to work from that mental model versus thinking as a trader.
I appreciate that, Chris. I think, you know, it hints at one of my very favorite economic concepts, which is this concept of the greater fool. And when you think about trading, so often what we see is individuals that are buying something on the hope that somebody else is willing to pay more, that somebody else is a greater fool. And I think the reality is what we care about is what something should be worth, not what somebody else thinks it's worth. And so it really is about investing versus trading. It really is about valuing businesses that you own. And an important reminder that when you own a mutual fund, that's exactly what you're doing. You're buying a basket of stocks or a basket of bonds that's ownership interest or interest in the debt of a particular company. And so what you really care about shouldn't be what's doing well today or tomorrow, but which of these businesses are going to be around 10 years from now and continue to provide a source of revenue to the business, which ultimately gets paid to the shareholders, so that 10 years from now, it's worth a heck of a lot more than what it's worth today. And so I think that's kind of the key, right, is to look at periods like this as an opportunity to buy some of those high quality businesses that 10 years from now are going to be the things you're absolutely loving holding, but buying them at a little bit of a discount. And Steve, you rightfully point out, that discount may get a little cheaper, but I don't think you're going to be too angry 10 years from now that you bought it at 85 cents on the dollar instead of 80 cents on the dollar when it's worth likely a lot more down the road. Well, we enjoy doing the program for you as always, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.